You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good afternoon, everyone. I am Fred Harris, and I'm a nun resident senior fellow here at the Brookings Institution. I'm also director of the Center for the Study of Afro-American Politics and Society at Columbia University. And welcome to the panel on the role of minority voters in the 2016 presidential election. So this is a very interesting year, to say the least. 2016 has already been dubbed one of the most important elections in our lifetime. Issues of immigration, criminal justice reform, and growing racial and class divides have been front and center in this election cycle. One candidate has gained political traction by attacking Muslims, Mexicans, and immigrants, while the other most recently has labeled her opponent's supporters as baskets of deplorables. Oh, that's what she said. This is the political world that we are currently living in. Who would know, right, in 2008, given the euphoria over the election of President Barack Obama, where we would, the nation would proclaim a new post-racial era. And so this is where we are at this historical juncture. So here are some of the questions that we'd like to tackle. What do the shifting demographics of the United States tell us? What role will Black, Latino, and Asian American voters play in deciding the outcomes in key states during this election? How will candidates' positions on criminal justice, immigration, and the persistence of racial bias affect the vote in minority communities? Now, to get us started on this discussion, I hope we have a rigorous discussion. I think we will, given the talented people we have on this panel. We'd first like to get some background information. There's been a great deal of conjecture, speculation about sort of what the future demographic changes in this country will mean, which we're going to talk about in a moment. But what do those changes exactly look like? So, to get us started, we have Bill Frye, William Frye, who is a senior fellow here at the Brookings Institution in the Metropolitan Policy Program. Bill is an internationally regarded demographer known for his research on urban populations, migration, immigration, race, aging, political demographics, and his expertise on the U.S. Census. His latest book is, appropriate for this panel, is Diversity Explosion, How New Racial Demographics Are Remaking America. Bill?
Thanks very much, Fred. You know, I'm always surprised when a lively discussion about a current topic begins with a demographer. I don't know. But I think demographics is really important, especially important in this season, because the changing demographics of this country, especially with respect to race and ethnicity, is going to be central not only to this election, but to the elections that come along. And, of course, if you look at the population growth from the past 1970 up to 2050, in each of those years, the orange bar shows the size of the white population. The gray bar shows the size of the combined minority populations, blacks, Hispanics, Asians, Native Americans, Native Alaskans, and so forth, put together. We've been mostly a white society. And when we get to 2040, 2044, the Census Bureau says, we're going to be majority-minority, if you like that term. There may be another term when we get to that sport. But things are moving a lot more quickly before 2044, and we're going to be seeing that in this election. One of the issues, though, and that's going to be discussed here, is what might be thought of as a representation gap. what does the racial profile of the population look like compared to the racial profile of the people who show up on election day? I think that's an important disparity. Now, one of the reasons there is that gap is because a lot of the fast-growing minorities in the country are younger, more of them are under age 18, not able to vote, and among legal citizens or legal residents of the U.S., many have not become naturalized to become citizens. So in the 2012 election, among the white population, about 8 in 10 whites are eligible voters. Most of the rest of them were under 18. About 7 in 10 blacks are eligible voters. But among the Hispanic population, only 44% of the Hispanic population were eligible voters, not only because a lot of them were under 18, but also a fair number of them, while legal in the U.S., are not naturalized as citizens. Similarly, among the Asian population, only 52% are eligible voters. Now, as we move ahead, of course, every year it's been estimated that about 1 million Hispanic young people are going to turn age 18 because they were born in the U.S. They'll be citizens. They'll be able to vote. And hopefully with more efforts, there'll be more naturalization occurring among those legal residents in the U.S. We'll make that a little bit different. But there's another part of this, and that's probably going to be the major part of this discussion today, and that's registration and turnout of those people who are eligible voters. And so I have another chart here, which shows sort of three sets of bar charts. The left three are for the elections of 2004, 2008, and 2012, showing the total population racial composition. The orange part of the bar is the white population, the other part of the different minority groups. The middle three are for eligible voters, and the left three are the voting population. You can see as you get to the voting population, it's a lot whiter than it is of the eligible voter population or the total voter population. In 2012, 74% of voters were white, according to the Census Bureau's current population survey. 74% white voters compared with only 71% white eligible voters and only 63% white in the total population. Those shifts have a lot to do with this representation gap. And the key part of this gap, of course, is between the eligible voters and the actual people who turn out. 8% of voters on election day in 2012 were Hispanics, but 11% of eligible voters were Hispanics, and 17% of the population was Hispanic. Nonetheless, Barack Obama won, and I think, you know, I've written about it and I've talked about it. I think the minority population, it can be calculated, is responsible for his win. It's both of his wins, 2008 and then 2012. And the reason is even though we have this kind of representation gap, there's been huge turnout among the minority population in 2008 and 2012. Here's a chart that shows the turnout rates in each of the last three elections for whites, for blacks, for Hispanics, and for Asians. In 2012, for the very first time, there was a higher turnout for blacks among eligible voters than among whites. And this had a lot to do with the results of the election. It's true that Hispanics and Asians have lower turnout rates in general. Only about half of them turn out. It means there's a much higher ceiling to reach. But still, for the last two presidential elections, they had higher turnout than most of the previous elections prior to that. So that inflated the size of the voter population beyond what the demographics were compared to previous election. Of course, the other part of it is who did they vote for? And as in many past elections, the white population in general voted Republican, very heavily Republican, as a matter of fact. But we had a very strong Democratic vote among blacks. Blacks have voted Democratic since 1936, and in big numbers since the Johnson administration in 1964. But also bigger votes for Democrats than in the past for Hispanics and for Asians. And so, you know, it's the demography, but also the turnout and also the voting that helped Barack Obama win the presidency. And, you know, he won by about 5 million votes. And of those 5 million votes, the net gain given to him by minority populations was 23 million. The net number of votes given to Romney by the white population was 18 million. So that's 23 million for minorities for Obama, 18 million for whites for Romney. He won by 5 million votes. That's a huge amount of votes. And I think, you know, going forward in history, the changing demography and what can be done about turnout and registration is going to be important. Now, I want to say a little bit about the Electoral College before the panel comes on. That top map there shades states by the percentage of eligible voters who are minorities. And those dark blue states, more than 35% of the eligible voters in 2012 were minorities. That includes Nevada and Arizona, Texas, New Mexico, and so forth, as well as Georgia. So, you know, to get a sense of this, the state of Nevada in 2004, 80% of voters were white. But when we get to 2012, only 67% of voters were white. That includes the changing demography and the changing turnout of especially the Latino population, but also the other racial groups. So this is what's going on. It's occurring because there's a dispersion of Hispanics and Asians and other groups away from these kind of coastal areas to the middle part of the country, but also a huge migration over the last 25 years of African Americans from other parts of the country back to the South. Between 2004 and 2012, half of Georgia's gain in eligible voters is because of African Americans due to migration to the state of Georgia. Not surprisingly, that Georgia may be in play this time when you look at some of these surveys, assuming the turnout is right. So I just want to skip over this. Look at the last three elections. This is the red and blue America. The top map is 2004 results, the middle map is 2008 results, the bottom map is 2012 results. Of course, the last two are when Barack Obama won. But back in 2004, that's a typical Republican win up until that time. Republicans took the solid South, they took the Great Plains, they took a lot of the Mountain West. The Democrats were kind of stuck in the coasts and in the industrial Midwest and some of the farming country in the Midwest. Back then, it looked like Republicans were getting the growing part of the country. But as minorities started to disperse to the middle parts of the country, and as blacks continue to move back to the South, and of course we have Barack Obama as a candidate, we see in 2008 those states like Virginia, North Carolina, Florida, Colorado, Nevada, and so forth, moving into the Democratic column. And the reason I say minorities are so important is because when you look at those states, you'll see some of them are dark blue and some of them are light blue. The dark blue states were won by Obama, both because whites voted for him and minorities voted for him. The light blue states are the ones won by Obama because minorities voted for him, but whites voted for his opponent. So you can definitely say all of those light blue states, many of them important swing states in the South and in the West, have moved toward Obama because of the vote, because of the turnout, because of the changing demography of those minority votes. And by the way, another set of light blue states in 2012 are Midwest and Rust Belt states like Ohio or Pennsylvania or Wisconsin and Michigan. It shows the high turnout of the much smaller minority population in those states as being important to counter the white vote for Republicans in those states. So I guess I have to say, as the panel comes up here, as the demography moves further and there's this further dispersion of minorities to other parts of the country, as they become a bigger part of the electorate, probably around 40% when we get to 2028, it's very important to make sure that that representation gap gets closed, and increasingly that representation gap will be part of the turnout and registration gap that we have seen up till now, and that's why this discussion is so important. I think democracy depends on this representation being evened out, and I think demography is a large part of that demographic shift. So thanks a lot, and I'll invite the panel to come up here.
Thanks again, Bill, for that great presentation. It really is going to help us through some of the discussions that we're going to have this afternoon. I'd like to introduce the panelists. To my extreme left is Michael Funtroy, who is an associate professor of political science and associate chair and graduate program director at Howard University. Where he teaches courses in African-American political behavior, American political parties, interest groups, and national government. He is the author of Republicans and the Black Vote, a book that analyzes the historical relationship between African Americans and the GOP. Next to Michael is Maria Teresa Kumar, who is president and CEO of Voto Latino, which is headquartered here in Washington, D.C. The organization deploys marketing strategies, campaigns that leverage new media and technology to encourage Latinos, which is, as we see, one of the fastest growing demographics in the U.S. It encourages them to get involved in the political process. She started her career as a legislative aide for then Democratic Caucus Chair Vic Fazio and is a graduate of Harvard's Kennedy School. Dead center is Ron Christie, who is founder and CEO of Christie Strategies, a political consulting group. Hope you don't mind being in dead center.
Okay.
From 2002 and 2004, he was acting director of USA Freedom Corps and special assistant to President George W. Bush. He began service at the White House in 2001 as deputy assistant to Vice President Cheney for domestic policy, advising the vice president on policy initiatives in healthcare, budget, tax, and other policy areas. He is the author of Black in the White House, which was published in 2006. To my immediate left is Deepa Iyer, who is a senior fellow at the Center for Social Inclusion, an activist in resident in the Asian American Studies program at the University of Maryland. At the Center for Social Inclusion, Deepa provides analysis, commentary, and scholarship on the ways to build racial equity and solidarity in the light of rapid demographic transformation in American society. Deepa is the author of the book, We Too Sing America, Langston Hughes-esque title. South Asian, Arab, Muslim, and Sikh immigrants shape our multiracial future. Let me say that again. We Too Sing America, South Asian, Arab, Muslim, and Sikh immigrants shape our multiracial future. The book was published in 2015. So with that, as you see, we have a very esteemed panel here. And we're going to start, I'm going to give you a few minutes to provide an introduction to what's at stake here in this election, particularly given the various constituencies that you represent. And so to get us started on what we should be thinking about, what are the major issues, and so Michael, why don't you get us started.
Sure, thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. So, as you all know, there's an election. You may have heard about it. And one of the key questions that I get a lot is, so what are Black people going to do? And while I always say I don't know, I say all I don't know in part because there is a sense of ambivalence and agitation in many parts of the Black community around the country, and I'll talk about that in a second. But in terms of contextualizing all of this, you know, any prognostication about where we are in terms of this election has to begin with the obvious fact, which is Barack Obama's not on the ballot. Now, I teach 18 to 22-year-olds in undergraduate courses at Howard, and one of the things that I've had to come to terms with is that many of them were in middle school when Barack Obama were elected. Now think about that for a second. For many millennials around the country right now, college age, they don't really know much of a United States without Barack Obama as president. And so while it's obvious that he's not on the ballot, what's less obvious and less well known to many of those folks is that in 2000, Al Gore got 91% of the Black vote. And the question then becomes, there is a unique and huge opportunity to reshape American politics for black voters if, as Bill pointed out in his great remarks, if the turnout and enthusiasm gap, if you will, is closed. But how do you do that when a large segment of the black population is somewhat ambivalent about the nominee for which most black folks, for the party, for the nominee of the party for which most African Americans have voted over the course of the last 50 plus years? It's possible that Secretary Clinton could get a similar slice as Al Gore of the 2016 pie, but the pie may well be smaller than it was in 2008 or 2012. And ironically, it's possible at the same time that the black vote as a proportion of the actual national vote could be a small slice of a bigger pie, because we don't necessarily know if African Americans are going to feel enthusiastic about showing up to vote. Now, why might they feel less enthused? Well, you know, all segments of the American populace have what, depending on the issues that mean most to them, could have very long memories. And there are some African Americans who are still angry with Secretary Clinton over the 2008 campaign. There are still African Americans who are upset with President Clinton over welfare reform or the crime bill or a variety of other concerns. And so for those voters, there is some ambivalence about Secretary Clinton. Now, conversely, you got to vote for somebody. And if you're not going to vote for Secretary Clinton, the next largest likely alternative is Donald Trump. And stop giggling. And the reality is that Donald Trump is going to have historically low support among African-American voters. Some of you may recall 1964 and the Barry Goldwater campaign, in which he got 6% of the vote. And Donald Trump is currently polling at about 2% among African-Americans. And of course, these numbers don't always pan out on election day, but think about that for a second. If he comes out at about 2 or 3%, that's, you know, a third to a half of what Barry Goldwater got in 1964. You know, I think that speaks to just how deep a hole he has created for himself in the upcoming election. So, a little more context. There have been 22 presidential elections since 1936, when we had even rudimentary polling information. And only once in those 22 elections has the Republican nominee received 40% or more, and that was in 1944 when Tom Dewey ran. Only three, Wendell Willkie, Dwight Eisenhower, and Richard Nixon, got between 30 and 39% of the black vote. And more recent Republican nominees have been significantly worse off and generally running in the 10 to 15% space. Setting aside for a second the historic headwinds that John McCain and Mitt Romney ran in 2008 and 2012, respectively. And Donald Trump right now is polling at about 2%. Now, that's the bad news. The good news, of course, is that he has room to grow. So as we sort of look forward to November, I think that the key point that we need to also factor in, and I'm not quite sure how we do that here, but that this campaign at some level, as it pertains to African-American voters, is being conducted in a context of backlash, racial backlash, in which many African-American voters feel that the successes of healthcare and the presence of an African-American president have driven some people to distraction in such a way that someone like Donald Trump could emerge. And in some respects, I think Donald Trump is sort of a vessel for a larger concern. So I just wanted to put that on the table in terms of what's at stake. Well, you know, Donald Trump asked the question, well, what do you have to lose? Well, you know, African-American health care, health insurance coverage is down, has been expanded. That could potentially be something you lose. And whether it's unemployment or educational access, a variety of other real policy concerns, it's possible that African Americans, in fact, have quite a bit to lose depending on the outcome of this election. And I'll stop there.
Thank you, Michael. And thank you so much for Brookings for having such a timely conversation. I think that when you ask Fred what is at stake, it's not a direct business as usual election this time. I think that this is very much an asymmetrical political environment where we try to start talking about issues, but we aren't actually addressing the massive demographic changes that our country is undergoing, as Bill explained in his presentation. I don't think that Donald Trump phenomenon happened overnight. I think that we have an increased bifurcation in our media, where for the last 15 years, a news outlet has been pumping the problems of America squarely on the shoulders of people of color. And I think we saw the beginning and rise of that through the vice presidential candidate of Sarah Palin. And Donald Trump is a continued vessel for that in many respects. For the Latino community, I would say that everything's at stake. And what I mean by that is, for the very first time at Voto Latino, we have parents sending us emails and providing us information on how, for the very first time, their parents, their children are coming home crying because their classmates are telling them that they're going to get deported when Trump becomes president. The problem with that is that 99% of these kids are American-born. So after this election, whoever wins, we still have to figure out how do communities heal. And I have not seen leadership from either party to actually talk about the broader conversation that we need to have with the browning of America. And people take exception with the browning of America, but Bill, as you explained, it's the browning of America. Generations, the millennial generation is the most diverse generation. For the very first time this year, Generation Z is going to be eligible voters. They're more diverse and bigger than the millennials, who are bigger than the baby boomers. They're all, can you hear me? Is the mic, sorry. Is that better? Thank you. For the very first time, Generation Z is going to be it's going to be larger than the millennial generation and more diverse. It's also going to be the last white majority generation. So if you were to ask me what is at stake, is that for this election, it's also going to decide potentially the next 25 years of policy. And what I mean by that is that we're not talking about just traditional types of legislation, but we're also talking about, better? Thank you. She's fantastic. She's back there. But we're also talking about what's at stake when it comes to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court right now is actively looking at Voting Rights Act. They keep revisiting it, or threatening to revisit, which I hope they do soon. They are looking at health care for women. They're looking at and revisiting immigration policy, environment, and more recently, affirmative action. And those are all issues that are going to impact us, again, not now, but for the next 25 years, when we're talking about how do we grapple with a massive demographic shift. We also have to, you know, and we also are dealing with something very different that we've never had, where for the very, well, in a long time, and at least for the very first time in my experience, where we've had political candidates, when they start losing, start claiming that the system is rigged. And as a result, it does an incredible disservice to our democratic process. It does an incredible disservice for folks that are for the very first time being primed to start participating in the political process, and makes our work so much harder. If you are a first-time voter and you are already not educated on the system, as many of the voters that we go after in Voto Latino, trying to surpass that has become hard, harder than usual. And to appreciate it, you have roughly 4 million Latino youth that have turned 18 since the last election. Those are 4 million people that more than likely have not received any type of civic education. I have been recently shocked when I found out that only 8 states require civic education in order to graduate from high school. when you have 51% of your kindergarten class that are people of color, more than likely are children of immigrants, where are they getting their education from? Most likely online, most likely are getting primed right now in political campaigns. And so our work is, we definitely have it cut out for us, but I also think that there is incumbent on the American Latino and our allies to make this a landslide election so that we can make sure that we can start focusing on the issues. I can tell you that if you were to raise your hands, 99% of you, if I were to ask you, what are the policies of both candidates when it comes to pay equity, when it comes to environmental policy, you probably don't know. But you all know immigration policy from one candidate very clearly. So it is actually a disservice to political discourse and electoral politics because we actually don't know what the issues are because they've been all concentrated on this issue of a racial divide. I think that it's fair to have a conversation on increased discomfort because communities are changing rather quickly. I always point out to candidate Edwards when he always talked about his coal mine town in North Carolina. That coal mine town today is over 53% Latino. So it's happening fast. But if you don't have leadership explaining why that's changing and how it's changing, I can understand the discomfort. And it's okay to voice that discomfort and not be pegged as, you know, as the R word, I call it, as racist. But it is not okay to basically not give voice in a way that is structured, as is happening right now in our political discourse. I do think, though, that the millennial generation, it can be incredibly impactful if they act. I know that that's a lot of burden to share, but what I mean by that is we don't appreciate that in the last 10 years we have had, and it kicked off with immigration, the immigration movement, but we've had millennials lead the immigrant rights movements where they walked out of their homes, marched and organized via cell phone and MySpace. You guys remember MySpace? Barely. But then shortly, and they were the largest coalition of civil rights marches in our nation's history that no one knows about. That was our Arab Spring that happened a good 5 years before the Arab Spring. Then we've had marches on the environment, Occupy Wall Street, a Choice, LGBT, Wage for 15, and more recently, Black Lives Matter. It's one movement, largely led by millennials who have the power for the very first time to outvote the baby boomers. We are in danger, and not to give slight to the baby boomers, but if there's not participation in the millennial generation, we're going to have something that's very akin and similar to what's happened in the UK when it comes to Brexit, where, again, you have a generation that is voting for their own self-interest but not looking for the future and building that future dialogue. And I say this in closing. I think that my concern is whether or not you're going to have a group of Latinos that are going to vote for Trump and make the difference. The electoral map makes that virtually impossible. He needs at least 40% of the Latino vote to do that. Mitt Romney, with his self-deportation policy, received 27%. My concern, though, is that they're not turned on to participate. Unlike the African-American vote, this is going to be very much generational. You have older Latinos who remember their prosperous years under the Clinton administration in the 1990s. It was one of the highest attainments for them for home ownership, you name it. The millennials don't remember that. Generation Z definitely doesn't remember that. So that's one concern. The other concern is that this is going to be the very first presidential election without the Voting Rights Act. And Shelby County versus Eric Holder that gutted the Voting Rights Act was done in 2013. It was the fifth largest county of Latino growth. And by fifth largest, I'm talking about over 200%. Every single state that followed had 100% growth in Latino populations in the last census. It is not by accident. I think it's more of saving back the future, of trying to figure out what do we do with this new electorate. The fact that you have a presidential candidate that is now saying that, again, the system is rigged, and so that he is right now enrolling volunteers to go man polling is, to me, something that should be of concern of every single American, because there should not be thugs that basically prevent participation. Then the last thing is for us, I do also think that this is a moment, and this is my last point, but I do think that we are living a moment that could be very similar to what happened in California during Proposition 187. Proposition 187 basically was, I would consider, the first racial profiling law under the guise of immigration reform, under Governor Pete Wilson in 1993. on a personal note, I'm completely political. My family's apolitical. They don't know where I came from. But I remember coming home from college and having this conversation with my family. And for the very first time, my grandmother, my four aunts, and my uncle were considering becoming U.S. citizens. That had never happened. Those are the conversations that are happening right now in households across America. And if it happens, there is a reason why that political problem, that political opportunity where all of a sudden California no longer became, it was no longer a swing state, but became progressive, was because of the participation of the American Latino. It is also now why 25 years later, you have two senatorial candidates that are Democrats. I'm not advocating for one party or the other, but this is what happens if we are able to build the infrastructure of actually creating a voice among a population that underperforms, but that is increasingly overgrowing incredibly quickly. And what I mean by that is it's expected that so today we have 27 million Latinos that are eligible to vote in the 2016 election. It's expected by 2032, we're going to have 17 million more. The majority of Latinos, while the average age is a 27-year-old, the majority of Latinos right now cluster around 14. So we haven't even hit the wave of where they're of that boom, I could say. And thank you so much.
Okay.
Ron?
Let me see if I can get this thing to work. Good afternoon, everybody. Gosh, so quiet. I think this is a missed opportunity election for the Republican Party. If you look at the last election cycle, the 2012 presidential election cycle, you had African Americans voting by a percentage of the population of any other demographic. Mm-hmm. And then our friends at the Republican National Committee came out with their postmortem analysis of what did Mitt Romney do wrong and what can we as a party do right to sort of right the ship. And they spent several million dollars on that, and of course, we really don't have much to show for it. I could have really done this for about 50 cents rather than several million of how do you make meaningful inroads in communities of color. When President Bush was first elected, he got 9% of the black vote, subsequently reelected with 11%, and frankly the only reason that he won reelection in 2004 was he got over 40% of the Latino vote. So clearly there was a gulf that we have gone into as a party, and how did we get there? And more importantly, to this election, what are the stakes? The stakes are Donald Trump. And I, as a conservative Republican, look at this nominee and think, my goodness, we had 17 people when this started, and now the music stopped and the chairs are all filled with Trump and Pence. How did we get here? And how can we rebuild our party? How can we retake the party of Lincoln from the party of Trump? And I wrote a op-ed, which is not going to get me on the Trump Christmas card list this year, in the New York Times, and it was entitled Talking Down to Black America. And I was stunned at the Trump campaign. So for the last more than a year, Trump has been going around the country saying what he's been saying, doing what he's been doing, but not making inroads in communities of color. And then he said, aha, there's an election coming up in 60 some odd days. Let's go to Detroit, go to a black church, and bring along Ben Carson. That's it. That's black outreach. And I really went to town on him on this op-ed saying, that's not black outreach. That's not making significant inroads in communities of color to show up to a church. Because last time I checked, not all black folks go to church. Not all black folks show up in Detroit. So how do you do it? What's the proper way forward? And I spent 8 years of my career on Capitol Hill working for then House Budget Committee Chairman John Kasich. And when Kasich was reelected as governor of Ohio a couple years ago, he got 27% of the black vote. And people are like, oh my gosh, John Kasich got 27% of the black vote. How did he do that? And my answer to that is always simple. John Kasich doesn't talk to black people like they're black people. As in, you don't show up to a church. You don't say, oh, let's see, outreach to African Americans. Let's talk about crime, welfare. Let's talk about job training because, you know, all blacks are poor. All blacks live in crime-infested neighborhoods, and, you know, they really don't care much about education. And it's the soft bigotry of low expectations that President Bush famously talked about that John Kasich has done so well in, and I think the reason why he's gotten 27% of the African-American vote is that let's talk about the kitchen table issues that matter. Parents want their kids to go to a safe school. Parents want their kids to be in an environment where their kids can thrive in school. And more importantly, once they graduate, to find a well-paying job. How can the government help in this regard? Rather than saying government's always the problem and or the government's always the solution, how can the government be a partner to help families succeed and to attain the American dream, ergo 27% of the black vote? And so I look at my friends at the corner of First and C Streets Southeast, otherwise known as the headquarters of the Republican National Committee, if you're watching there. Get with the program. Recognize that there is no such monolithic entity as the African-American community. We're all individuals. Yes, we might be people of color, and yes, there might be certain kitchen table issues that appeal to more folks based on their ethnicity, but it's e pluribus unum time, folks. I mean, out of many, one. That's what the United States is. We're from many different backgrounds, many different races, different ages, but we are one. And I just flew in from the Kennedy School this morning and sat down with a group of African-Americans at Harvard, and your point is absolutely right. If Republicans want to win, you better get to the millennials, because they are going to be the force to be reckoned with in the next election cycle. And you don't get it done by talking about all the things you're going to do to divide America. You're going to do it by talking about all the ways you're going to bring America together as a country. And that is a party, is a vision that I want to try to fight for, of restoring the Grand Old Party to being the Grand Old Party and not in the divisive state that we find ourselves today. We've got a long ways to go, but I'm confident after this election we can start rebuilding the party and having more of an appeal to people of color and millennials. Thank you very much.
Deepa?
Thank you. So thank you again to the Brookings Institute for convening this important discussion and for inviting me. So not being a data person, whenever I hear presentations like Dr. Fry's on the racial demographics, I get really optimistic and really excited. But then reality kind of, you know, sets in. And, you know, as many people have said, demographics are not our destiny. And the numbers are not going to translate into economic and cultural and political power for people of color in this country or change our lived experiences unless we get to the root of what the disparities are all about. So for voters of color, including Asian American voters, whom I'm going to be focused on, the questions that come up in this election are, what are the policies that will substantively address the systemic disparities facing people of color, indigenous communities, and immigrants? And what are the ways that candidates at the top and the bottom of the ballot are actually addressing our national climate today? And it's a national climate that, as others have spoken about, is rife with racial anxiety, with anti-Muslim sentiment, and xenophobia. And so just a little bit of context for Asian American voters in this kind of broader climate. We're in the midst of a range of transformative phenomena happening in this country. One is obviously the racial landscape and its shift. Asian Americans are actually the fastest growing racial group in the United States. And so for us, the racial anxiety that is occurring as a result of this transformation ends up affecting us as well. And it affects us in a range of ways, whether it's pushbacks to voting rights or the rights of hate groups, for example. A second phenomenon that Asian Americans are affected by is the war on terror. The domestic war on terror in particular that was spawned after the attacks of September 11, 2001. So in the past 15 years, we have seen, for example, higher rates of employment discrimination, hate violence at the most safe spaces, places of worship, for example, profiling and surveillance, in short, Islamophobia, that is affecting Muslims, South Asians, Arab, and Sikh communities. And then thirdly, we're seeing anti-immigrant and anti-refugee sentiment. If you think of the xenophobic response by many American governors to Syrian refugees, the takers rhetoric that is reserved for undocumented immigrants, or the impact of anti-immigrant harsh enforcement policies, given that 75% of Asian Americans are actually still born outside of the United States, immigration policy and the ways that we treat immigrants affects us deeply. And lastly, we're seeing the systemic impact of decades of policies that have deliberately neglected, in particular, African Americans and indigenous communities, but also Asian Americans and Latinos. And there are overlays with class and immigration status as well. So how are Cambodians and Bangladeshis, who are living in higher rates of poverty, going to have access to education and jobs? How are Nepali nail salon workers, Filipino domestic workers, Indian H-1B workers going to have access to workplace rights? This is a context, both from a policy and a rhetorical standpoint, that political parties and candidates actually need to pay attention to if they want to be responsive to voters of color, including Asian Americans. So a couple of quick observations to draw about the Asian American electorate. The first is that it's no longer possible to treat us as an afterthought. For decades, that's what we have been. We're not usually counted in exit polls. Political parties don't make any investments in terms of outreach to us. But this needs to change because we are flexing our political muscle. 18 million Asian Americans, as I mentioned, in the United States today, and our share of the voting electorate has grown in tandem from 2 million Asian American voters in 2000 to 3.7 million in 2012. And exit polls are showing that high numbers of first-time voters, recently naturalized, are coming out to vote. We also know that Asian American voters can be particularly influential in certain states. So in six states, California, Hawaii, Nevada, New York, New Jersey, and Washington state, Asian Americans make up 5% or more of the citizen voting age population. So it's no surprise then that recently the Clinton campaign announced that it would be buttressing its outreach efforts to Asian American voters in Nevada, Virginia, and Pennsylvania. Second, important to connect to our issues and to the impact of the national climate. A couple of examples for that. A May 2016 poll conducted by AAPI Data, Asian American Justice Center, and APIA Vote found that Asian Americans are increasingly averse to the use of anti-immigrant and anti-Muslim views and stances in political discourse. Think extreme vetting, Muslim ban, that does not play well in our community. Secondly, Asian Americans are really concerned about issues like immigration, education, health access, the economy, national security, issues that all Americans are concerned about. But we also want to know how policy positions are going to affect our lives in particular. So when it comes to education, how will the government invest in supporting Asian English language learners, given that growing segments of Asian Americans are not proficient in English yet? Or when it comes to national security, how is the government going to deal with the impact of state surveillance that is devastating Muslim, Arab, and South Asian communities? Specificity and not a broad brush is important when it comes to our policy positions about Asian Americans. And lastly, knock on our doors. Asian American voter outreach is not something that has actually been invested in, as I mentioned. And we do know, over the last two elections in particular, that Asian Americans have tended to vote Democrat. 2014, an overwhelming 73% of Asian Americans, the largest racial bloc, actually voted to re-elect President Obama. And it looks like, again, surveys are showing that the Asian American community is aligned with Hillary Clinton. But this does not mean that the Democratic Party should take the community for granted. In 1992, the numbers were quite opposite, with more Asian American voters preferring George Bush to Bill Clinton. So to maintain the edge, parties need to make inroads with our voters through ethnic media, through in-language outreach, and to put Asian American faces out in our neighborhoods doing outreach for our communities. So in conclusion, someone spoke on this panel about the enthusiasm gap. Asian Americans know that this election is critical to play a role in, and there is really no enthusiasm gap. The May 2016 survey I referred to found that those polled were significantly more enthusiastic about casting a vote in this election than in previous ones, 51% in this election as compared to 28% in 2014. That is because the stakes are high and we know it. For Asian Americans and many voters of color, this election is much larger than who occupies the White House. In this moment in our nation's history, it's also about who's American and who's not, who belongs and who's an outsider. It is fundamentally a struggle about justice, equity, and belonging. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Deepa. And I'm so glad you mentioned that the Asian American vote should not be deemed to be the purview of one political party, because as we know is that when political parties compete for your vote or your group's vote, all kind of policy promises and positions are made. And in many ways, particularly when we look at the African American vote and particularly the Latino vote, they seem to be, will be a captured, in the case of Latinos, a captured constituency where in the future perhaps the Republican Party may just sort of write off the Latino vote, as it has done for African Americans. We can talk about that, because I want to make sure we have enough time for the audience. So put that aside for a moment, because I actually have another question.
That was a big question.
I would give you another big question. Maria, you mentioned the browning of America, mm-hmm. right? Michael, you talked about the racial backlash. That's occurring now. And I think in terms of the great Howard University historian, Rayford W. Logan, when he talked about the nadir, the sort of the lowest period in the civil rights of African Americans since emancipation between 1877 and the founding of the NAACP, when you had the erosion of African American rights. There were African Americans in Congress, and you had the increase of the Ku Klux Klan, white racist violence. And many people are claiming that we're in sort of this second redemption period, right, or a second nadir, in response to the presidency of Barack Obama. So racial backlash, the browning of America. Deepa, you talked about xenophobia. Mm-hmm. Is this an election of fear, where people are motivated more by fear than important substantive policy positions? And I think that's, I know I asked the big question before, but I think this is just as an important position. Why aren't, it seems that people are more focused on beating the other candidate based on what may happen than from, particularly when it comes to minority groups, a position of empowerment, mm-hmm. right? So someone want to?
Okay. I want to deal with the end of your question first.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, you know, why do we campaign on fear?
Right.
Because it's easier for me to get you to not want to vote for the opponent necessarily than it is to get you to vote on a particular range of issues that might be more substantive and relevant to your existence. I just think this is a tried and true political tactic that occurs at all levels of electoral politics. So part of this is sort of a natural progression of the way campaigns are run. The other guy's a bum. She's untrustworthy. Vote for me. It's part of it. Now, in terms of my comment earlier with regard to this racial backlash, I see the racial backlash as part of and a sort of byproduct of, as I mentioned earlier, the very existence of a black president, in this case, Barack Obama. And we see it in a few examples. Some of you may remember the name David Duke, who had been largely silent and marginalized over the space of the last few years, and who a few months ago went on his radio show, podcast, or whatever, and started talking very enthusiastically about Donald Trump. And that got a lot of attention, and Donald Trump then says, well, you know, I don't really know who this guy is. And turns out, of course, he knew who he was. But following that, you begin to see, or around the same time, you begin to see greater appeals to sort of the white nationalist wing of the American populace. And that nationalist wing, whether it is that nationalist wing is driven by both fear and anger. Fear about its place in the new America that we know is coming. And anger about the likely diminution, as it sees it, of its previous position. And want to push the brakes and make sure that the America that they were raised on will continue to exist, perhaps even in perpetuity. So when you add it all up, I think that the fear and the anger and the loathing that has emerged from some segments of the population in support of Donald Trump is a natural outgrowth of generations of racial priming and other tactics that have been used to create real uncertainty and discord in the American populace.
Yeah. Maria, you want to talk about fear?
I would actually disagree slightly in the sense that I also think that when Trump says, make America great again, he is trying to push back the future, yes, but I also think that he is touching on a chord of blue-collar workers that feel that they just can't make it, right? For as much economic prosperity that we're claiming, and granted, this is taking into consideration yesterday, the news report that came out that that middle class income has actually grown for the first time this year. Let's put that aside. A lot of folks have never recuperated from losing their home, their life savings. They are record numbers of people that are now living in apartments, multifamilies, and this is not people of color. These are poor whites. When you have, and for the very first time in among millennials, you had a large percentage of young white men that voted for Mitt Romney. And it's because they were not feeling and they are not living that dream that was promised to them, because they are straddled with student debt. They are now all of a sudden not starting their life, so to speak, because they find themselves living at home with their parents. So it's he is tapping into something that is very real that we have not had an opportunity to speak about in this election, because he has turned for the very first time in my recent history Americans against each other to actually give voice to the struggles that African Americans, Latinos, Asians, and yes, white Americans are facing. And how do you talk about this idea of a shared promise if the majority of the population that is either millennial or at once a blue-collar job was still considered stable middle class no longer is?
Ron?
I of course, take it from a different perspective than my colleagues have articulated thus far. And I do think that this is a fear election. And it's not just Donald Trump who is fueling the flames of fear. If you look at what Secretary of State Clinton said last week of the basket of deplorables, that over half of Trump's supporters are racist, that they're homophobic, that they're Islamophobic, that tells you something about a candidate who is trying to get her base to come out based on fear, and her folks to come out and say that if you vote for the racist Republican bigot, well, you know what you're going to get. Now, I have had my issues with Trump's Make America Great comment, because I think America is great. We don't need to make it great again. It is great. And it's a buzz term or a dog whistle, if you will, for those who want America to look like the days of Leave It to Beaver. And there's certain people, I mean, look, I'm not that old, but I love Leave It to Beaver. But I think so.
Rerun.
Frederick, you got to help me out, man. But I think really we have deplorable choices when you have deplorable candidates that appeal on fear rather than saying what they're going to do to strengthen the country rather than divide the country based on race, ethnic, gender, or sexual preference.
So I'm trying to make a couple of points that are different from the what we've heard. I think, you know, one thing to keep in mind is that, yes, it's a politics of fear, but it's not new. This has been something that's been percolating in the United States for decades now. Historically, people of color and immigrants have always been framed as threats, takers, others, invaders, right? But definitely over the past 15 to 20 years, and I'll use the frame of Islamophobia, since that's kind of what I've been working on. When we look at, you know, over the past 15 years since 9/11, both sides of the aisle have actually engaged in very volatile, vitriolic, divisive political rhetoric and discourse and policymaking. When you think about racial and religious profiling, surveillance, when you think about the hearings that were held in Congress by Representative King on, quote, Muslim radicalization, this is something that has been happening for quite some time. And oftentimes, it's also happening under the radar. You know, I write in my book about Islamophobia in the Bible Belt, with an emphasis on the state of Tennessee, where what we saw since 2010 is this, you know, this kind of coming together, this confluence of Tea Party conservatives, what we call the industry of Islamophobia, folks who are fanning the flames of this, you know, fear of anyone who is Muslim or perceived to be Muslim. And what it ended up in just that state were, you know, the introductions of anti-Sharia law, the obstruction of a mosque that was set to be constructed. People saying things like, well, you know, is it going to be a mosque or a jihadist center? You know, the fear-mongering and the language and the rhetoric used to say, well, these people are outsiders and they're threats, and we need to preserve our interests and to do that, we have to pass these restrictive laws. We have to make sure that they actually don't even have a place to pray in our communities, right? And that's the sort of rhetoric and policies that we've been seeing for the past 15 years. And I agree with you in terms of it's not enough to call it out. I think that, you know, we need our elected leaders to actually set forth a more inclusive vision of empowerment. It's not enough to just say, well, this is bad and this is what you'll get. What is that inclusive vision of a multiracial America that actually looks at what the most marginalized in our communities need? And that is why I think candidates have to be responsive to what the Movement for Black Lives is asking for what undocumented youth are asking for what Muslim communities are asking for. That is the sort of inclusive vision that I think we need to see for it to go from fear to empowerment.
Okay, we're going to open it up now for questions. You know, as a professor, I always like to go to the student who's the furthest back. So, you're not a student, but the woman with the glasses? Yes. Yes, you. Wait for the mic.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Elena Beverly. I'm with the University of Chicago. I wanted to ask a question of the panelists, but particularly Maria Teresa. I appreciate your comments about Generation Z and millennial voters, our younger voters, so to speak. There recently was a survey conducted by the Black Youth Project and Associated Press NORC about that generation, millennials being not monolithic in their approach to policies, particularly when you break it down by race. We have varying positions, and I'm wondering, to what extent are we seeing the candidates speak to issues to engage the millennial voters, to engage Generation Z on everything from police brutality to racism, because I think that we're race baiting but not discussing racism, to issues including immigration. And my second question is more for William is demographically, what do the candidates need to do? I mean, how many of the millennial voters or how many of Generation Z do they need to win?
So it's interesting. I was just cramming for this because I just received the study that you referred to, and a couple of the things that, in, not a surprise, but I think that might be a surprise to the audience, is that 68% of both African American and Latino youth, 18 to 30, believe that there needs to be stricter enforcement and criteria for when it comes to the use of police force. There's a lot when you look at people of color, especially when it comes to around the racial lens of enforcement by police, by racial profiling, by gun safety, an overwhelmingly number of them, 60% of them, actually believe that there should be some sort of restrictions when it comes to gun safety. Conversely, 58% of young whites believe that it should be basically that we should not touch gun rights, right? So that's where you see a big division. And the same thing comes when you start talking about racial profiling. 8 out of 10 people of color, young people of color, actually are concerned with white supremacist violence. 7 out of 10, conversely, whites are. Clearly, it's because I think that there's an increased pressure and concern. Sadly, and as I mentioned before, sadly, this presidential election has not really been a forum for issues. That we are not battling intellect, and we are not battling nuance and differentiation. We're in neither case, right? And if for the folks that tuned in on the Commander in Chief Forum, it was sadly not only asymmetrical, but I love politics and I love presidential elections. This is what I live for, right? This is basically my World Series. I've never been so concerned that it has become so easy not to be fact-based, not to actually intellectually challenge your opponent, and not to actually try to capture the hearts and minds of all Americans. And that's what the purpose of politicians should be. And we are not seeing that in a very straightforward manner. Part of it is because when you start talking about race in this election and this idea of extremism, one candidate decided to bring the alt-right into the belly of his campaign. And the alt-right, for the folks that may not know, are the ones that are perpetuating a lot of white supremacy across the board, that are incredibly misogynistic, as well as Islamophobic, right? And so it's hard to distinguish what those issues are, because they haven't really hit the forefront. That said, if you follow very closely Donald Trump's use of language, he is finding ways to split, I would say, young African-American men from this. When you hear him talk about undocumented immigrants and immediately talk about the reason why young African men do not have jobs, it's because there is something there that he is tearing apart. And I've had, and these are anecdotal, but I've had conversations with a lot of young men that are in service sector jobs in the African American community that, without skipping meat, tell me that they're voting for Trump. So it's so he's touching something there. When he did the speech on immigration in, it was a hate speech in Arizona. There was no reason why he was talking about vouchers, but it was to actually hit to the heart of African American communities' concerns on that. No one talked about it, but that was very much who his audience is. So when he goes into black churches, yes, it's not all, but it's very much he's speaking in tones and in dog whistle that even are behind closed doors conversations that are happening within communities, but has not really been out in the open.
William Fry, you want to chime in?
So somebody talked about numbers. I'm pleased that this panel has recognized I'm pleased that the panel has recognized that millennial population is now maybe 45% minority in terms of its makeup. You don't normally see that when you look at a lot of the popular press, when you hear them talk about millennials. But in terms of voting, in general, the young adult population, age 18 to 34, 18 to 29, but millennials are now 18 to 34, tends to have the lowest turnout. And I think especially among the minority groups, even among the black young adults in 2012, despite the high turnout among the black population, it was lower among the young adults in 2012 than it was in 2008. And among the other groups, Hispanics and Asians, it was again much lower than some of those other groups. So I think in terms of the potential of millennials can do a lot, but I think they need to overcome two barriers. One, that young adults typically don't vote that same amount, don't have that high level of turnout, and the kind of the minority turnout, especially among Hispanics and Asians of that group, there really needs to be a lot more energy put into that to have them fulfill their potential in terms of their numbers.
Yes, Bill, I just have a quick follow-up question on that. But it is true that African-American youth voters had a higher turnout than Latino and Asian youth.
Right. But the younger ones, not as much as you.
Right. One second. I just also want to remind people, I suppose I've done this earlier, that if you're tweeting, it's hashtag 2016 voters. And so just want to remind people of that. Let's see. The gentleman in the shirt. Oh, gentlemen, Sasha, but the guy right here. with the computer in your hand, yeah.
Hi, everyone. Tyler Newhall from Quicken Loans. Thank you all for being here, and I think this is a really important topic and discussion. So I'm pretty young, but I'm starting to see a lot of parallels. And Maria Teresa, you started touching on it a little bit with white voters and a lot of their fears. And I think you can see some parallels with the Midwest losing a lot of manufacturing jobs, but also the heroin epidemic as well, with looking at crack cocaine, et cetera. And my question is, and maybe more directed at Ron, what do you see the future of the Republican Party? Because I think you do see them supporting things like criminal justice reform, in terms of a little softening on drug enforcement, but also trade adjustment assistance, et cetera.
Boy, nice simple question to throw at me. Look, I think the Republican Party needs to have a very strong introspective look of how do we get to be a party of prominence. You recognize that we control a majority of the state capitals. We have a majority of governors across the United States. So there are clearly people who believe that the conservative brand or the Republican brand is the right one in states. So how do you translate that to a national level? I think you're absolutely right. I again go back to my old boss, John Kasich. I might not be a fan of the Affordable Care Act, but one of the things that governors have had the opportunity to do is to expand Medicaid to allow more folks who didn't have access to health care to get on the system. And one of the things that I found with what's happened in Ohio, for example, is that Kasich's justification for expanding Medicaid in Ohio was, look, we have a lot of people who need mental health issues or need access to care, and if you can get these folks in the system, they can heal, then they go off the system, and actually cost the taxpayers less money than more. And so there's a way of looking at what the system exists and saying, I'm going to work with the system, I'm going to help people. And so in order for us to be a majority party, to regain the White House, to keep the White House, I think it's going to have to be a broader appeal to people of color. It's going to have to be a broader appeal to the millennials. I mean, it's no joke. My friend Elise Stefanik, who was the youngest woman elected in Congress, she was elected 2 years ago at 30, will tell you that the millennials tends to be more conservative. They tend to be a demographic that is increasing and flexing its power of going out to vote. So if you get a more brown and a younger population to vote for you, I think that's the way to go. But you've got to talk about the issues about what you're for as opposed to what you're against or people that you perhaps don't like for whatever reason based on their religion or their ethnicity or where they came from originally.
Good afternoon. I am Dr. Sharice Nelson, a former student of Michael Fongtroy, so I'll put that disclaimer out there before I start. But my question is to absolutism. And when did we start seeing a trend of having to be all for or against? Because I think that to me is the overarching issue here across demographics and across ethnicities is that if you latch onto a black voter, it may be welfare, it may be the crime bill. If you latch on to a particular white voter, it may be, you know, Islam. So we've made this to be an absolutism type of participation. And how do we get out of that? How do we move away from that? And what does this election do for that?
Professor?
Okay. Well, absolutism is a significant problem in America's public discourse and in American politics generally. It's, you know, there used to be a time where partisans could disagree and it not be necessarily a blood feud, and unfortunately we're away from those days. You know, there's a great book out, published a few years ago, called The Gingrich Senators. And if you get a chance to read it, take a look at it, because it helps to trace how we got to a sort of absolutism in Congress. So, you know, the author traces it to the 1994 elections and right around that time. I think absolutism is part of our discussion because it works. It boils things down to a lowest common denominator and makes it easy for someone to say, yeah, that makes me mad. And so I'm going to vote for this person, even though this person opposes virtually everything else that I support. But because they oppose this thing over here, we're going to go with that person. So the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And so I sort of see it that way. And until we can have a more fulsome and reasoned conversation and public discourse, I think this is sort of where we're going to be for the foreseeable future.
Deepa? I want it deeper.
Okay. It'll be short. No, I was just going to say that, you know, along with the browning of America, I think there's also been kind of a dumbing down of the American electorate as well, you know, and I think that that's what leads us to see these issues and communities in these monolithic ways. You know, for Asian Americans, we are often seen as a monolith, but we are an extremely diverse community. So if you even look at an issue like immigration, for example, you know, we can't assume that all Asian Americans, say, are going to prefer legalization for undocumented immigrants, except for the fact that we're seeing in our community larger and larger numbers of undocumented immigrants. So these are conversations we're having internally within our communities as well. How, when we talk about being a community of immigrants, how are we supporting those who face a lot of stigma within our community for being undocumented and being out of status? How are we connecting with, as Maria Teresa talked about earlier, African-American immigrants, right, who might not understand what the issues are that they have in common with Asian-American immigrants. So I think that there's both, in terms of, you know, pushing back against that absolutism that you talked about, I think it's really important not to see voters as a monolith. It's important to have these nuanced conversations about policy issues and how they affect each of our different communities, about learning about each other's histories in this country. We don't do enough of that because we're so siloed. You know, whether it's neighborhoods or schools or communities, we have gotten to a point where we're more siloed than we actually ever used to be. So I think that it's really important to address it from, you know, from the standpoint of political education, internal community mobilization, nuancing the issues, and get away from this siloism that is also leading to the absolutism.
Ron is not going to like this at all, but I actually think that in order to get away from that is that we have to stand, the Republican Party has to go through a cleansing. And I think one immediate, almost overnight cleansing is basically to have a tsunami election of opposition to Trump so that the Republican Party can actually say, this is not something that is good. And what I mean by that is if at the end of the day, a candidate, and again, this is more about, in the way, in my view, it's very much about where is it that we're going to have political discourse in the future. If we basically have an opening where it's only a 51% win, for example, for one candidate, that does not give a particular party any need to do a real insight cleansing of what needs to happen. Whereas if it's a landslide election, that's very clear that this is not what is acceptable or that's going to build a possibility of future, it allows the Republican Party to really have a coming to Jesus. Right now, one of the reasons why we don't have, I think Paul Ryan is having such a hard time in Congress, is that he has legislation that he may have, perhaps would like to pass, but he has roughly 28 members of Congress who are highly gerrymandered districts that won't budge. 40, I'm sorry, 40, that just won't budge, even though they are in safe districts. So unless there is a real alignment within the Republican Party and they get the clue that the majority of American people, and that, I'm not talking about progressives, but I'm talking about independents and Republicans themselves saying, this is not the party that holds my value right now, is, I think that's the only way we're actually going to go back into fighting for voters.
Except, though, there was a tsunami election in 1964 with Barry Goldwater, and then in 68 we got Law and Order Richard Nixon. So, mm-hmm. Just a historical footnote.
Goldwater should become president.
Yeah, there is that.
Yeah, well, that's true. So, we lucked up. We got Richard Nixon.
Fred, can I jump in for
sure,
2 seconds on this?
Yeah.
I want to go back, and I associate myself with the comments of my colleagues on my left here for their sort of view on absolutism, but I would say, Michael, I'd go back a little further than 1994. I would go back to 1989, and this is where I think the absolutism came in. So you go back to 1989, and a backbencher from Georgia by the name of Newt Gingrich knocks off Speaker Jim Wright. And then Gingrich becomes Speaker of the House, and then it's payback time to the Democrats. Then Nancy Pelosi comes in and says, aha, it's payback time to the Republicans. I'm going to get you. Boehner did the same thing. And I also think the 40 folks that we talked about in the Freedom Caucus and the House of Representatives, anything that President Barack Obama's for, they're pretty much automatically against it. And I look back to Rush Limbaugh. I like listening to Rush Limbaugh. But I remember his comment when he said, we have to make sure that the president fails when he came into office. And I thought, my God, what a terrible thing to say. The president is the president of the United States, not the president of the Democrat Party, but he's the president of the United States. And finally, for being one of those recovering lawyer, recovering lobbyist, and current pundits, I also think that the 24/7 news cycle has driven this. Because if I go on MSNBC, you know darn well Chris Matthews is going to get in my face and scream at me and say, you terrible Republicans. If a Democrat goes on Fox, you can pretty much think that Sean Hannity or the like will jump on them. And it's, you're always wrong, I'm always right, I'm not listening to you. And I think that when people see this 24/7, and then as Michael mentioned, you go back to these gerrymandered districts where over 90% of members of Congress are going to get reelected, they don't really face partisan opposition, and they can say, well, the heck with these Democrats. Look how crazy they are. Vote for me. Look at these silly Republicans. Look at their... So when you throw all that together, I think that we're in the absolutism spot that we are of we need to do a better way of choosing our candidates to run for office, and we need to do a better way of cleaning up the airwaves so it's not I'm wrong or I'm right and you're wrong all the time.
Yeah, I would also throw in social media and that gumbo that you just described, because I think it's also contributing to polarization too. Yes, this gentleman here in the suit. Yes. Can you wait for the mic?
Oh, sorry. Hi, my name is Ewell Anderson. I represent the African American Future Society. And Ron, just to add to your comment, what do you think about concentrated power in the hands of George Soros or I forget the guy who runs all the newspapers at the moment, and Rupert Murdoch, and how you may feel that the direction of the 24/7 news media is coming from the top? And how do you see that playing on the characterization of minorities and voting?
You know, I'm always leery when you have people who have the money and the ability to influence people's perceptions. And of course, for being a conservative, I applaud people who are entrepreneurs but who work hard. And I will take your question and I'll flip it in a slightly different way. I worry about the rise of dark money in politics, of untraceable money for ads that can go after people and based on race or their ethnicity or other factors that you have no idea who these characters are, who these actors are, who are poisoning the well. And so, yes, Murdoch, I think, has a very strong empire, both in Australia and here in the States, with, of course, owning News Corp, which is the parent company of Fox News, and Soros has his influence. But when you hear about Soros or the Koch brothers and, you know, unregulated money, that's what worries me. Of post-Citizens United, which I supported, but I think the outcome of Citizens United is an outcome none of us could have ever predicted and has led to the proliferation of money in the political system that has really poisoned the well.
I want to go all the way to the back. There is someone who has their hands up.
Winston Wilkinson. I actually live in Bethesda, but work outside of the area. And every once in a while, I'm here in D.C. And just want to shout out to D.C. I had the opportunity this morning to go to an event where I just heard from FBI Director Comey, and then can walk across the street and come here this panel. So I want to thank Brookings for this opportunity. Director Comey actually mentioned something you guys just spoke on about kind of the silo where you have folks who kind of operate in their own little silo with other people who think the same, and mentioned how that has made his job difficult in terms of governing. And so I wanted to agree with that. But my question is, I saw a poll, actually a report a couple of days ago where it listed, there was actually a poll about how whites view us African Americans or their hatred for. And it's clear that there's definitely some hate there. And so when you say that Trump is responsible for this, I want to ask you, do you think it makes sense to flip it and say that maybe Trump's not responsible for this, but maybe he's kind of being a smart marketer and just kind of giving people what they want, and that if that's kind of driven his success? And then a second question with that is, there's obviously a strong group of people who are, again, they might not all be racist, but they do feel certain ways about immigration and about certain minority groups. What happens when, you know, Trump does lose? What does that block of people do, and how does that impact the next election cycles and actually how we, you know, how we govern ourselves?
I can tackle the last part. I mean, I think that's why, I mean, that's, I mean, my concern is that he's started to create and mainstream the alt-right and create something that he has the foundation that for the next person that is savvier than he is can very well take the reins. And that is something that, and that's why when I say tsunami, it has to be the American people standing up to this in order for it to be very clear that part of our hearts and minds is not going to be, it's not who we are.
That kind of tsunami. Okay.
Yeah, I would echo that by saying that I think that, you know, regardless, right, of who gets into office, we're going to have to deal with what has been started, what has bubbled up, what is percolating under the surface. And even, you know, with, for example, Trump kind of empowering or reinforcing some of the sentiment against people of color, we have already seen a lot of repercussions of that, right? I mean, whether you're thinking about, you know, violence at rallies to actual policies that have been put in place in certain states, like English-only policies or anti-refugee policies have actually been introduced in several states around the country just over the last 6 months since the election started. So it's really empowered, yes, the alt-right, but also others, right, who feel that they actually are finding people of color and immigrants to be threats and are taking it into their hands or into policy. So I think that it's going to be a time of both healing, but also a time to really reconcile with ourselves what has happened as a result and how we're going to organize and mobilize around that.
Okay. Well, if you have a very quick question, because we're hitting up against the clock, so. Sorry, this is going to be our last question.
So we talked a little bit about what candidates are doing to outreach to the minority community and millennials and other communities in general. And one of the tactics we're seeing is surrogates. Mm-hmm. We saw Ben Carson being used with Donald Trump at churches. Barack Obama spoke on Tuesday. Michelle Obama is speaking on Friday. Can we talk a little bit about, you know, how we think surrogates are going to be helpful, if they're going to be useful, and really what demographics you think they're going to be appealing the most towards?
Okay. We have a couple of responses on that.
Quickly, from my perspective, it all depends on the quality of the surrogate. To Ryan's point, I think that to the extent that Donald Trump, for example, had an opportunity to get in with African-American voters, if I could use that phrase, I think you can't do that with Omarosa as one of your primary, one of your primary surrogates. And you just can't. And oh my goodness gracious! Yes. So I think a lot of it depends on who is it that you have speaking on your behalf. If you have serious surrogates, people who have legitimacy and credibility within communities, without regard to the color of the community, I think you have a shot. But if you don't, then you know you're really not providing anything serious to a community other than the kind of symbolism that we've seen recently.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, as you see, there's a lot at stake in this election, and minority voters are going to be critical. I think we've had a great discussion. I want to thank Bill Fry and our very capable panelists for a great discussion, and hope to see you again in the future. Thanks so much for coming.